morning, all, and welcome to our regular meeting. It is 9 a.m. on Tuesday, November 1st, 2022, and time to convene the regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Toni Olson, Board President. To my right, we have Board Vice President Rebecca Wolf. To my left, we have Board Secretary Sid Logan. Further to my right, we have Joe Fina, Acting General Counsel. John Harlow, CEO General Manager. To my left, we have Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board. And in other various places in the room, we have Jenny Wrench, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzer, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please remember to mute or turn off your phone and other electronic devices. This session is for the board and the CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and PUD staff. John, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson. Good morning, commissioners. We have lots of good stuff on the agenda today, so we'll get right at it. First up is our media update, our amazing Julie Cunningham.
Good morning. Happy Yesvember. I like to call it Yesvember instead of none of that no stuff. Yesvember has arrived, so good morning. So with this time of year come storms, and we had the wind blow in, so it was good. Aaron was working the storm this last weekend, and we got to meet with many of the reporters we generally work with. So good chance, not a big storm, and brushing off all of the talents to get ready for the season. Everett Herald carried that Como, they had coverage on Como and coverage on Cairo for our latest windstorm. Kelly worked with a reporter from the Kitsap Sun. We don't get to work with them very often, but was interested in our Arlington microgrid, which is real smart. They're, I guess they're looking at some of that over there, and the Kitsap Sun ran a nice story about the microgrid. Bill and Tommy got some additional recognition. The Mukilteo Beacon and My Edmonds News both covered their Governor Life-Saving Award. The Flex Energy Program was covered by Virtual Peaker and had a story in their blog. Our new app, we have an app. I hope everybody's downloaded that. The cool thing is more than 6,000 of our customers have downloaded our app already. So getting some attention, our CSS team's excited about that. My Edmonds News and My Everett News both have been helping us promote that. And other things, the Connect Up program is going to be featured in the APPA Power Magazine this month. The Hat Island Cable that we've been working on will be in the Bulletin, NWPPA Bulletin Magazine this month. And Aaron is taking a new Herald reporter, photographer on a tour of ops this week to show them how we get ready for winter. We're all always talking about reliability and storm prep this time of year. So our power talk this week is on all of our efforts around reliability. John Heave and Zach Scott are going to be presenting on the efforts we've been making that will help our customers stay in power and get power back quickly. And our Herald column this Saturday, I think it is, will be on reliability and storm prep as well. And don't forget, Sunday is daylight savings time. We fall back. And I brought to you all one of our race, the scarves we handed out at the race, featuring our new Zip and Zap. They were popular out there at the race. Let's see if I can just unpull this without. There we go. Zap on our. Everybody's going to want one of these. It's all the fashion, all the rage. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's only one?
There's three.
No, we're going to fight for it.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thank you. Thank you, Julie. So next up is grants to the utilities for residential customer arrearages. Jeff Feinberg. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, commissioners. Jeff Feinberg, Senior Manager of Energy Services and Customer Innovations. Thank you. And I'm excited to be sharing with you guys the latest in a series of updates that you've kind of gotten on this program kind of throughout the pandemic. And so This has been something that's been underway for a long time, both with the legislature appropriating these funds back in January, but even before that, our government affairs team, along with a few other utility workers, have been working with the governor's office and state legislatures at trying to solve this problem of how do we help some of the customers that have had some increased challenges due to the pandemic. And so what you're hearing from me today is the first of two updates. So today is a big kind of broad high-level update of where we're at in the process currently with the Department of Commerce. And there is going to be a little bit of an ask at the end of this. And then in 2 weeks, we will return and we'll give kind of our utility-specific update regarding what we believe this will do for our customers, how many households, things of that nature. And so the first thing I want to acknowledge before we get into the actual presentation is I am going to ask you to do something that I know is not our preferred path, and that is we are presenting something this morning and then we are asking for a vote later this afternoon of approval to enter into a contract with the Department of Commerce. And so just want to say that up front. We know that that's not the preferred path. This is a little bit of a unique situation because the timeline is really kind of sped up and picked up all of a sudden. And so we, in order to have the most time possible to kind of implement and be a part of allocating these funds, when we know those amounts, we really want to give ourselves as much time as possible, hence the ask for a vote today. The second thing that I want to say is I represent a big, broad group of people that have been a part of this from the very get-go. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Clark McIsaac's name, who is no longer with us, but was extremely important kind of in the initial stages. I know, you know, Clark and our team started talking with the governor's office probably back, I feel like maybe some in 2020, but especially I know in early in 21, we were already kind of having conversations with legislators about, you know, what can we do and that something needs to happen. So government affairs has been involved, you know, Kim, Marian Daka, our consultant, customer service, finance, and so many analytics, so many people have been a part of these conversations leading up to this point. And next, in 2 weeks, whenever we come back, I'm going to name every name, and I'm just going to make sure you guys know all the people that were a part of this, because it is one of those where this has been a good example of it was an opportunity for our customers. We took action, we had to involve a lot of our team in order to get to where we are today. And the last thing I'm going to say before we get to the actual presentation is I also think it's really important to say this both to you guys because this is the group that leads our team, but also because I think I want the public to know that we don't get to where we are today without the leadership of people like John and Pam and Kim that are constantly empowering us as the staff to go out and try new things and to innovate and to pursue things. And to not be afraid to kind of go maybe where we haven't gone before. And I just want to say that because getting to work in customer and energy services, it's a blast. And it's a lot of fun to work for this leadership team, our entire executive leadership team that does, you know, tell us to not just go and be good, but to go and be great and to innovate and to just keep pushing. So anyway, I want to say that because I'm encouraged by that every day.
Jeff, I hope you feel our support too.
I do, most certainly.
We are cheerleaders for you.
Most certainly. We certainly do. Thank you for noting that, and I should have said that as well.
No, I mean, we really are your cheerleaders.
Yeah, thank you. All right, so the specifics of this program and what we're talking about today. Let's see if this is the right button. Thank you, Jimmy. Wrong button. All right. What are we talking about? There we go. Okay, so what are we talking about? So the legislative framework. Back in 2022, the legislature appropriated $100 million for public and private water, sewer, garbage, electric, and national gas arrearages. This was not the original ask. I think the original ask from utilities all across the state that had kind of been canvassed, it was a larger number, but $100 million is what we settled on with the legislature. And at the time, the proviso was written for funds that were accrued between March 1 of 2020 and December 31 of 2021. And you'll recall, that's also when the governor imposed the utility moratorium on disconnects, which for us, we had already made those decisions before we had gotten there. But that's primarily what the legislature was trying to treat with some of these funds. And really, where this kind of came about from the get-go is there were several different federal pay packages, right? There was ARPA and there were CARES, but in all of those pay packages, for say a consumer-owned utility such as ourselves, there were no direct lines to some of those federal funds to support our customers. And so up to this point, really what would need to happen is we would need to work with those partners that do receive those funds, whether it's in Duwamish County, whether it's the federal LIHEAP program, and we would need to figure out the fastest and most seamless process to get those funds directly to our customers. So that's part of why Clark and our government affairs team started some of these conversations, is to say, you know, what about us? Because there's some other needs here that haven't been addressed yet with some of these federal packages. So that's where the conversation started. So as the proviso has been written, the customers that are going to be eligible for these grants are customers that have participated in LIHEAP, LIWAP, which is the new low-income home water assistance program, and also ratepayer-funded assistance benefits are eligible to receive funding. And why I think this is really important to call out, this is one of those things that we as a team here at PUD worked hand-in-hand with the legislature on, making sure that ratepayer-funded assistance was included in this. And just to kind of paint the picture of why that's been so important and going to be important for our customers, throughout the pandemic, when we kept looking at our numbers of where arrearages were compiling and maybe customers that would be eligible for disconnect had we been going out and doing regular disconnects, throughout the pandemic, roughly 50% of the customers that we had seen that were eligible for disconnect had no prior disconnect activity with us in the 2 years prior to the pandemic. So let that sink in a little bit. And that just kind of shows the staggering situation our customers and our community finds itself in. And I know that there's tons of other statistics out there, but I think that was one of the compelling ones for us, that when we thought about who should be eligible for this assistance, it's not just customers that have traditionally been low and moderate income, but it was customers that were suddenly low and moderate income because maybe they missed one paycheck, maybe their whole industry shut down for a few months, maybe they were greatly, you know, put on greatly reduced hours. But what we saw were the effects of that in our community were immediate, and we saw that. And so by being able to include ratepayer funded assistance, we have a lot of customers that are going to be eligible to receive grants from this program that would not traditionally be eligible. And another piece of that too is some of those other federal packages had already kind of emboldened LIHEAP and LIWAP programs with additional funding. And so this gives us the opportunity to not only serve those customers that are traditionally low and moderate income, but also those customers that are in that unique situation because of the results of the pandemic. And so what are some of those programs for us? You know, it's going to be customers that participate in our rate discount. It's going to be customers that have participated with our community support program that we started. It's also going to be customers that have been on payment plans. And when we're thinking about payment plans, you know, during the pandemic, customer service worked really hard to look at payment plans, and maybe in some use cases, it made sense to put a customer on a 36-month payment plan instead of our traditional 12-month, so that they could pay down their debt, but also cover their current usage. And so these customers will also be eligible for these funds. So we're really excited about kind of the broad criteria that Commerce has been working on with utilities so that we're able to serve those, not just the most vulnerable traditionally, but all vulnerable customers. Not sure where to point. There we go. All right. So process steps. So when Commerce opened this up, they asked all utilities that were interested to apply, and 99 interested utilities applied by Commerce's deadline of May 27th, 2022. We were one of those utilities. And then kind of throughout the summer, both in the initial application process and then some subsequent meetings, we sent them different data points as they requested, because one of the things Commerce was trying to do is trying to understand what is the actual need and how far will these 100 million go and what kind of criteria needs to be built. So we participated in several workshops. We've participated in a lot of Q&A. Marian Daka, again, who's working with our government affairs team, has been so important and influential, both not only for our utility, but a lot of utilities across the state working with Commerce. We had our most recent Q&A with Commerce on Friday that she set up so that all utilities could get a real comfort level of how this is unfolding, and we can get our questions answered. And Commerce has been really very helpful at having these conversations with us to make sure we all are on the same page. But the four variables used to determine our allocation as Commerce does this work is, number one, what is our percentage of the aggregate arrearage of all the utilities that are participating? They also wanted us to submit, and we've shared, what our funding totals have been to support arrearages so far. And I think that's another important piece, because we've been really aggressive at trying to make sure that our customers have lots of tools to combat these challenges. And instead of that kind of going against us, when they can see how much of our arrearages we've been able to work down through those programs, that is also one of the variables used in assessing how much we will receive in additional funding. And then the service area, as it relates to the Department of Ecology's Environmental Health Disparities Map, which you'll recall is also a piece of CETA legislation, and then also service area detail as it relates to American Community Survey poverty data. And so those are the four variables that Commerce is using to determine how much of this $100 million each utility's customers will receive.
So do you have any idea why they picked aggregate arrearage as opposed to qualifying customers?
Yeah, I think part of that was because what we found was that the aggregate arrearage of residential customers was quite a bit larger than the $100 million. And so I think what they kind of did is zoom out and first understand how large is the problem, whether customers are eligible to receive these funds or not. Because, and then we can kind of target the eligible customers. And on one of our other data requests, we got into the specifics around the customers based on the eligibility that Commerce had established. What are those arrearage numbers? And so they kind of zoomed in as we've gone through the process.
So, Jeff, what is the American Community Survey? I mean, I've never heard of that. And usually the census is something that there wasn't a very reliable census.
Correct. And so the American Community Survey is taking more frequently than the census data. And so that's a good question. To get back to you on that.
Okay.
But it's a tool that I think is a little bit more flexible and a little bit closer to in the moment, and can get a bit more granular than the census. Because again, the census is dependent on participation.
It's a very tough one.
Yes. Yeah. Any other questions? And I should have said that along the way. I know I'm just sharing information, but please interrupt me, ask questions as needed.
It is conducted by the Census Bureau.
Oh, yes.
Same people.
Can you guys just say?
Oh, yes. Commissioner Logan, do you agree with Commissioner Wolf's request? Oh, we already have the answer. I don't need the answer.
He was going to come back with
There's no need for him now to come back with that information as requested by Commissioner Wolf.
Yes. So next steps. So where are we at? So our ask today is that later this afternoon that the board would give us approval to agree and establish our contract with Commerce. And I will say that contract was the draft version was reviewed by Ann before she left us. Joe's also had an opportunity to take a look at that draft contract. And so what we're asking for is approval to take this step, because that's the next step needed to kind of continue this conversation with Commerce and then understand about our customer allocation and the continued rules as they're developing. And by the way, that's kind of a in the moment, day by day thing right now of working with Commerce, the Attorney General's office, so that we really understand what customers are eligible so that we can make the right decisions of how to allocate these funds once we know. Not to mention we need to do our back-end reporting here later. We've got that information all taken care of. So what happens after the contract is once the allocation is finalized, we'll work across our teams. And again, that big broad team that I'm talking about, and we'll determine prioritization if needed. And then we are tasked with distributing these funds to our customer accounts by December 31, 2022. So that's roughly 2 months from right now. Not only do we need to receive these funds from Commerce, understand the rules, but we need to turn around and apply them to customer accounts, which we're excited about the challenge. And I'll say, I know, Merry Christmas, Happy Thanksgiving, all those things, right? And Scott's team and so many other teams. I mean, I can't say enough about the analytics team. We've been working on this for a long time. So once we have our number and once we have all these rules clarified, we're ready to take that action. Customer service is behind us. So we're ready. We've just kind of got to get through these next steps with Commerce to make sure we understand our guardrails as we implement this. And then finally, we will report back to Commerce by March 1 of 2023, the results, how many households served, and all those great details, and hopefully some really great customer testimonials as well. And CourtCom has been involved too. I haven't said their name yet. We've been working with them on how we're going to message and share this. So that's where we sit today. Where we sit today is we need your approval for the contract. In 2 weeks, I will be back. I'll be digitally, but I will be back and I'll give you more detail about what happens next. But I'm happy to answer any broad questions about this program.
The question is just a comment. You know, I'm so impressed with how the whole organization pivoted during the pandemic. And I think you really put it well, Jeff, when you said the leadership said go and degrade. I think it takes that kind of work in an organization to pivot so quickly. Because we pivoted in every department so quickly. And I'm so proud of the work that you and your team have done to help our customers out and are still doing. So. Will be a yes, Denver, Julie.
Yeah. Yes, Denver continues.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
I appreciate your.
This is good news.
It's good news, exactly. These are the fun presentations for sure. Thank you.
Appreciate your dedication to this.
And I'll just also pile on to Jeff's comments. I don't know that folks realize the extraordinary lift this was, Jeff, and as he said very well, the number of folks that were involved. But also, again, we should be very proud of this team's influence, not just for us specifically, but on the overall process and the relationship that we have with Commerce and how that influenced the outcome for all utilities in this process. The team just did extraordinary job.
Well, and I think it's so wonderful that we started before we had to, or told to, before that conversation even happened. I mean, I think this is part about being a financially healthy organization, and when those emergencies happen, we're able to step in. And so,
yeah,
I just think we took a risk to help our customers. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
I did find one question. Did I interrupt you?
No, nope, go ahead.
Was the on page two in terms of qualification for Snohomish PUD, was that the community support program unique to us?
So that is our community support program that we're referencing
okay. There.
And then several other utilities kind of based on some of the work we were doing
okay. And
their plans set up similar plans. And so those are kind of pandemic specific support programs.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Example of leadership at its finest from Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. All right, next up is Delfina with commencement of district's consideration of our new PURPA standards.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
Joe Fina, acting general counsel, and today with my presentation, the goal is to brief you on two new federal standards that the district has to start considering, and to formally start our process of that consideration. So,
okay, excuse me, Joe, for those of us that are on the phone or coming via Zoom, can you tell us what PURPA means?
Yes, it's the Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act of 1978.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. So last year, with the infrastructure law that was passed, it was a very large law, but buried in there were two amendments to PURPA, and those amendments require states' regulatory commissions and non-regulatory entities like ourselves to consider those two standards for adoption. And those two standards are the following. The first one deals with demand response, and this includes policies rates mechanisms that are meant to mitigate any stress on the system during periods of high demand. And then there's an EV charging program, a standard. Also, the policies, and those are meant to promote charging infrastructure, the customer experience with EV charging, and also to encourage third parties to invest in that charging infrastructure. So under the law, we have to start considering it by November 15th, 2022, and we have to complete our consideration within 1 year. So this is not a new process for us. Back in 1978, there were six standards that we had to consider. Then in 1992, there were another four. In 2005, there were another five. In 2007, there were another four. So we've done this before. Under PURPA, there's a specific due process that we have to go to. And basically, when we make our determination on whether we want to adopt the standard, that can only be done after we provide public notice and a hearing. And that has to be in writing and has to be based upon findings and upon evidence that are presented at the hearing and has to be made available to.
But through all this, it's considered, right? It's not requiring us to do anything except to go through a formal process to consider.
And because we've done this so many times, our predecessors developed specific procedures for us to go through, and that's in our Directive 74. So the way it works is the district staff will develop the recommendation, and then we'll publish the public notice announcing that we're going to consider the two standards. Then we'll have a public hearing. At that hearing is where staff is going to present the recommendation, and then we'll allow for public comment. And then after that, district staff will go ahead and put a resolution together, either to approve or perhaps to disapprove at a subsequent open board meeting. And then at that open board meeting, then the board will take action. And during this entire process, staff is going to compile a complete record from start to finish of how we went about our consideration.
Joe, are these hearings?
We will have one okay. Hearing.
So this seems pretty burdensome, considering they're already working on both the demand response and electric vehicle charging. Or is this going to be onerous to go through the process, and does it need to be?
So I think one, it goes to show you that the district is kind of ahead of the curve,
right?
In many respects to those two areas. There are a lot of smaller load-serving entities that are public power entities that have to go through this process. Unfortunately, it's just a matter of you going through the process and making sure you have all the checks are marked on the check boxes. But I think for our purposes, we've done this before. We know how to do it, and we have a good team that's going to be looking at it, and that will present a recommendation. So I think in terms of resources and time on our part, I think we're probably in good shape.
Okay.
So our proposed timeline and our working plan moving forward. So today, again, we're formally starting our consideration of those two standards for the record. And then starting in 2023, our staff will begin the process to review the two new standards and prepare the recommendation. Our team leads for that are going to be Brian Booth and Garrison Marr and also Shelley. And then in late summer, early fall 2023, we're thinking we'll have our hearing. And then in late October and early November 23, that's when the board will take the formal action. Again, the action can be We're not going to do it. We are going to do it. We're going to do something in between. It's really up to the board. So that's all I have to answer the questions.
Commissioner? Well, I mean, is there a comment period, public comment period involved? I mean, I'm not concerned about it really, but typically regulations go through that.
There is, and we have that ability to establish what that comment period is, and so we'll do that in our public notice. But I understand that the team, however, is going to be reaching out to various stakeholders between now and then, and so I think there's going to be some outreach.
Kind of questions.
Great, thanks.
Nor do I. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks very much, Joe. Next up is 2023 poll attachment rates, and presented by Felician Ng. Good morning, Felician.
Good morning. Hi, good morning. I'm Felician Ng, Principal Utility and Economist here at the REITs Department, and I'm here to give you an update on poll attachment rates. So, like I said, the purpose of this presentation is to update the board on the new rates, and if approved on November 15, these will go into effect on January 1st of 2023. So, a little bit of background on poll attachment. Currently, the district has about 87,000 attachments, of which roughly 27,000 are district board polls and 60,000 are general. In total, these bring in about $1.7 million in revenue each year. The last rate increase that we've had was in 2020. We did review the rates last year, but found minimal change, so we left them as is. But I did want to mention that we do review our poll attachment rates every year, ever since 2018. Prior to that, we did have large gaps, but that isn't the case. As far as how the rates are calculated, we follow the methodology set forth by the Washington State, which was enacted in 2008. It's composed of two parts. The first part is the FCC cable attachment method, which was established in 1978. This formula does benefit the attachers more, as the formula only considers the usable space of the pool, which you can see on the diagram is the blue and the red section. And it removes the bottom half of that pole from the equation. And it was written as such to provide subsidies to the cable attachers at the time to foster growth. But the other half of the rate is the APP assured cost method, which takes the cost from that bottom half of the pole and actually share it across almost all users. But there are some areas where we make assumptions that differs from the standards. The first one is the space occupied by the attachment. The standard FCC and APPA assumption uses one linear foot per attachment. However, we, the district, have an agreement with our attachers to use half linear foot instead to allow for more attachment on the poles, and which that in turn reduces the attachment. The second one is the pole size. The standard assumptions is to use 37.5 feet. We use 45 feet in our calculation because that is more reflective of what we have in the field. And that again helps reduce the attachment rate. The last one is the safety space. Traditionally, safety space is considered unusable space. However, we also have another agreement with our attachers to treat it as usable space instead. So that again reduces the attachment rate.
So you said that the attachment rate is reduced on the space one. If there's only one attacher on the pole, do they still bear the same discounted cost?
Yes.
That they could have a neighbor 6 inches away?
Yes, because that's how we calculate all the rates all across the board.
I think it might be obvious, but when you talk about rate, you're talking about the price, not the rate, like the speed or.
the price that we charge for attachments on the pole.
I did have, if you go back to the diagram, what would be considered the part that would be the unusable space?
So the support and underground, nothing, there's nothing on there.
I see, that's what I was, I guess, thank you.
Okay, so with all those into consideration, the current rate that we charge on district owned poles is $27.98. We're proposing for that to go to $29.39. And for those on jointly owned poles, it will go from $15.38 to $16.16. That is a 5% rate increase. And the primary driver for the increase is the increase in our cost of poles and also the increase in our cost of maintenance and administrative costs. The expected annual the expected annual revenue increase is about $105,000. We've notified our attachers of this rate increase in July, and we have not received any. Sorry, we have not received any concerns so far.
So, is Sibley's rates similar? Aren't they our joint party? Or?
Mm-hmm. Actually, don't know. I don't know.
Please come to the microphone.
Sorry.
Thank you. Beth Haskin, Joint Use and Permits Administrator. Sibley, as a renter, is charged the exact same rent. Sibley, as a pole owner, actually buys into the pole at the time of set or replacement.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. This is my last one, so just to give you an idea of where our rates will fall in comparison to some of the utilities around here. I will note that not all utilities update their rates on a regular basis or review their rates on a regular basis. So you'll see after their names, there's a year following that, and that's the last time that they've updated their rates. I think the best comparison up there is Seattle City Light. They recently reviewed their rates, and they also have poles with joint ownership. So pretty close comparison. And you can see that our rates are pretty in line with theirs. That's all I have, and I'll take any questions if there's any.
No more.
I have none.
So are we charging enough to recover our cost?
Yes.
Thank you, Felicia, and great job. And last, an update on our energy storage briefing. And I'm going to have Jason introduce this one.
All right. Thank you, John. Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
So I am here to introduce the presentation. We've got a great cross-functional team that's been working on this, and they're going to walk you through it this morning. Going back to our 2021 IRP, there was an action plan in there, and included in that action plan was the pursuit of utility scale storage to help address our capacity needs. So this team has been working on that for the past year. It includes generation, distribution energy services, power supply, and finance. So the team there, and you'll hear from many of those members this morning. So our agenda, first we're going to do a quick refresh on the why, so why we're pursuing this energy storage, and then talk a little bit about the what different technologies we've looked at here in 2022, and then the when, so the when and next steps. So what are the next steps, what's the schedule, that'll all be kind of laid out this morning at a high level. This is just an informational briefing, no decisions this morning, but course, questions, we welcome those. So with that, I will turn it over to Garrison.
I'm not nearly as tall as Jason, so I'll just adjust this like that. Perfect. Well, we're going to start off with
Garrison,
the
Garrison, would you mind introducing yourself?
Absolutely.
Dialing in.
It's Commissioner Olson. I'm Garrison Marr. I'm the Senior Manager of Power Supply, and I might be a little too fired up this morning, so I apologize. Jumping the gun there.
Storing energy.
That's right, yeah. Caffeine specifically.
Too much caffeine.
That's right. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the why energy storage, and it's really a refresher. And there's also some good news here in maybe some reference to Julie's Yes Vember, some of the positive things headed our way. And then I've got a broader team that's going to help talk through the what, the due diligence that we've done across calendar year 2022, and talk about how did we settle upon this specific commodity grade energy storage product that we have. We'll talk about the when. There's some really important financial reasons for the when that is important for this commission to know about. And then we'll talk a little bit about the how, and that's really lining up our next steps, which is we've done the first cut of due diligence. There's another cut, and part of that starts to move towards procurement processes. So for today, there's no decisions being made. This is just a briefing, but would welcome any questions that the commission has so that we can have a good conversation. And we'll jump right into the why and the when. And the first part is, you know, it wasn't long ago, it was December, right, of last year, that we adopted the 2021 IRP, which laid out the resource plan that we see in the chart on the right here. And this chart includes several items that we have already done or are doing. So we've got some winter market purchases there. We've already made 3 of those winter's purchases. Those are already done, knocked out. For conservation, you just heard Jeff Feinberg come up. Him and his team have done a fantastic job going after that teal blue color and making sure that we hit our biennial conservation goals. You've also seen teams report the pilots of the Flex Energy and Flex Rate programs for demand response. We're doing some exciting work behind the scenes, creating a blueprint of how to take things to scale. That is going to address the purple area of that chart. So we're making a lot of progress on this long-term resource strategy, but we haven't talked together about this navy blue section, this energy storage. What is it? When does it come in? What will it look like? That's what today is all about. So this isn't new, but this is saying, here's how we think we can do this to make this plan work. So just a quick refresher about the importance of this. You know, we're not in a position right now where we can do nothing. And the reason for that is that our demand for electricity from our customers is growing. Right? We're seeing more electrification, more connections, economic growth in our community, you know, all positive things. At the same time that that's occurring, our portfolio is going to shrink if we do nothing. So we have wind contracts, those are on term length contracts. Some of those term lengths are coming up for expiration soon. We have to have the plan in place to meet our load service needs across time when we know demand's increasing. That's why we have the resource strategy that we do. And this chart here just shows a little bit about the energy and the capacity components of that and how it relates to some of the things that are changing in our portfolio. The other thing that we know is that our resource strategies are pretty stable across the very many scenarios that we looked out into the future at in the last IRP. So we looked at everything from low economic growth to high economic growth, high technology penetration in our sector of the market, high policy changes across the Western United States, and high electrification in Washington and the Pacific Northwest. Across all of those scenarios, there was a lot of common elements of things that we had to do across the next 10 years. Some of those common elements include the market purchases, which again, we said, great, we'll do it, we did it. The conservation investment, which we're chipping away at, and then also the storage investment, right? All of those scenarios has that there. So we want to make sure that we're making that proactive resource acquisition happen, because we can see in a lot of different futures we could face It'll have utility for us, and it'll result in one of the lowest cost portfolios for our customers. The other piece that I would want to remind us is, you know, in the IRP, we generally have a section of things that staff is directed to do, a section of things that staff is directed to study, and a section of things that staff is directed to participate in or learn more about. There were really three things that staff was directed to proactively do. One was pursue all cost-effective conservation. The other was pursue acquisition of significant long-duration utility-scale storage. And the last was develop that roadmap, which I told you just a moment ago we are doing, of how to get those demand response programs to scale. So this is really, you know, kind of a refresher round, but we've been doing, you know, what the IRP asked us to do, and we wanted to share what that due diligence process has looked like and where we think we can make that next step and make this plan a reality. It being Yesvember, you know, it's incumbent upon us to talk about something positive that's happened in the time that we adopted this plan to today, and that's effectively a 30%-ish discount on the sticker price of energy storage that we would have already been pursuing as a result of the resource strategy that we had. This is a result of the Inflation and Reduction Act, which was passed, that has new sections in it that now treat storage as a eligible resource type for investor tax credits. And it's a nuanced law, but here's the basics. So there is an existing investor tax credit program now that did not include storage. And that program was extended for projects that start new construction by New Year's Eve 2024. And that's an opportunity for us. It includes storage for the first time. It also allows new opportunities for tax-exempt public utility districts or municipal utilities to access those tax credits. So it changes the operating environment, it changes the market for these resources, and crucially, it provides, you know, 30% or more in tax credits of the capital cost of the project. So that's terrific news for us, because we were down this road and this came about, and it's really going to reduce costs for our customers. There is another part of this law that kicks in after 2024, after the, you know, the New Year's Eve ball drops there, and we're into 2025, and parts of that are still being worked out, but we know what the parameters of the existing program are and what that means for us. So that gives us a little sharper timing, right? We wanted to have 25 megawatts in the 2024 time period. This gives us a very clear tax credit that we can access for the benefit of our customers, and that's in the 2024 range as well. So I'm going to pause there because I've said a lot and I've said it quickly. The thesis statement from my perspective is we really need to be making our resource strategy happen in order to face head on the challenges that our community will have with electrification and growing demand for electricity. It's a terrific problem to have with the tax credit program out there to help us access some of these resources, but we're not in the place where, you know, we can wait and see or succumb to analysis paralysis. We need to take some action, and this is just one of the things that we need to do. So that's just a refresher on the why and the when, and in case it wasn't clear, you know, we're really thinking 2024, 2025, that's the period where we need to be going. We'd like to start construction in 2024. We would like to have this asset operational for our customers November 2025. So that's where we're headed. I will look to my team to help me out with the what, which is where we're going to really hone in on 25 megawatt, 100 megawatt hour battery energy storage is the asset that we're looking for.
So, is that 8 hours then? Or is that 4 hours?
Yeah, you know, we're going to cut into that a little bit here in the due diligence finding, but maybe just to address that piece, we looked across the market for 8 hour energy storage that we could get in the time frame that we wanted. The long story short is there was not a shovel ready, commercially available 8 hour resource for us. And as a result, we stepped back and we did studies and we said, well, what can we do with the commodity grade? You can get it anywhere. Storage resource. We found that a 4 hour resource could meet more than 80% of the needs of an 8 hour storage resource at a fraction of the cost. And we can stack those. So this is kind of the down payment that'll give us flexible avenues as we see that load growth come on and how we want to respond to that.
It allows us to take advantage of this. I guess the tax credit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Garrison slide me. Maybe this was one of the previous slides and I just missed it. The 30% investor tax credit in the IRA, is that for public entities only, or is it public-private? Yeah.
It's not for public entities only. It used to be largely for private entities, which have that tax liability. What's new in the IRA and really positive for us is now there's a direct pay provision where we can access that. Even if we don't use it, right? Now the developers that are out there, the folks that are in that marketplace, know that they don't have all the leverage, right? We can do this ourselves. We can develop it, access those tax credits, or we can use partners to do it. So it makes it a more competitive marketplace. And our customers should, you know, really benefit from that.
Garrison, I think it's probably early to think about this, but a lot of our EV customers are buying storage for their homes and they have batteries in their cars. And so I know you're focused on utility scale storage, so that would not be utility scale, but is there any thinking about how much potential there might be for the customers themselves to contribute to the grid that way?
Absolutely. So in the 2021 IRP, we did look in the demand response potential assessment of what that could look like for us. It had a little bit higher transaction cost because at that time it was really new, right? So in this 2023 IRP, and I'm not here to scare anybody, but we're like really close to doing the 2023 IRP also and doing that kickoff. We'll readdress what's commercially available on the customer side and see, you know, kind of what the totality of what we could do together looks like.
25 megawatts, I'm trying to think, what would that serve? How much would that serve? How many homes, for example?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting resource because it's not an energy resource for us. It's a capacity resource. Yeah. And so really, what it's about for us is our renewable portfolio,
right?
You know, those rivers are running, that wind is blowing overnight, and you know, our customers, just like ourselves, you know, aren't really up and about and consuming energy quite as much overnight as they are during the day. That's a real opportunity for us to take that renewable energy overnight that otherwise could go into the wholesale market at a lower cost, store that locally, right? And then redeploy that in periods of time, really hours, not days, when it can better match the demand profile of our customers, whether that's from, you know, electric vehicles or just watching TV, those sorts of things.
Thank you.
Well, isn't the nameplate of Jackson like 100 megawatts?
112.5.
Yeah, so it's like you couple those two things together, that's a good 20% increase on the ability.
And you know, Brad's right here in the wing, so it would be incumbent upon me to say that 25 is the first leg of a goal towards 70. And so we know that we're going to need to grow our portfolio as our customers' demand grows as well. So this is, you know, best viewed as a down payment on where we need to go alongside the other complementary investments that we'll make.
And Kirsten, I just wanted to ask something on that 30%. Just so that we're all aware, the Large Public Power Council and the American Public Power folks have been pushing to get comparability on the tax credit for many, many years. I think they haven't had it since 1986. I think so. So I know that we've been very supportive of that. So it's just a really, really big win for public power, at least on the IRA.
Right. Well, we've got some more slides to go through here. And Jason mentioned that we've got a big team because we have had a big team working on this. So I'm going to ask Brad to join me here as we talk a little bit about the due diligence process that we've undertaken in 2022 to talk about how we got to the place we're at now.
Thank you, Garrison. Brad Spangler, Senior Manager of Generation. Garrison did a great walkthrough of the why and the when. So now let's talk about what. I can actually jump back a few slides. I really like the sand chart on the right-hand side because it, for me, I'm a visual kind of person. It shows me that we need to have 25 megawatts by 2024. We also need to have 70 megawatts by 2029. We're going to build, wouldn't we just build the 70 megawatts in 2024? That was our first look. What we have figured out now, the two best technologies that we saw that would be in that size range are pump storage hydro and a new technology called liquid air energy storage. We've talked about these a little bit in the past. A few years back, we did a reconnaissance countywide, even outside the county, to look at pump storage hydro locations. And we came and briefed the board that we had three sites that we were looking at, two in the Spada Basin and one that was possibly down at Callaghan in King County. The only past site is the best hope that we have. And so we've been continuing with due diligence on that. If you look at a pump storage hydro project, it can have a lifespan of 100 years. So when you invest in something like that and take good care of it and you use it, you've got a long-term asset, like the Jackson project. Jackson project was built in 84 and its bonds are paid off in November of 24, and it'll be cheaper than Bonneville. It's already cheaper than Bonneville. So when you look long-term, it's best to own versus rent from that perspective. But we have to see how long does it take to build it. So when we looked at pump storage hydro, it takes us about 10 years to license and construct a big project like that. There's also questions about should we partner, should we better size it? Some of the folks in the industry have told us, you're looking at something that's kind of small, it's going to be more expensive, it's better, more cost effective if you go larger. But we don't need larger unless we have partners. So there's a lot of due diligence, both from a market and a partnering perspective. We've been doing environmental reviews and so forth. All that to say, about 10 years from due diligence, start of due diligence till commissioning. But we don't have 10 years. So we need to do something, but we're not going to do pump storage. So then we looked at liquid air energy storage. There's a great pilot project in England, right next to the Heathrow Airport, but it's small. It's not commercial scale. There are other commercial scales that are proposed, but they're not yet built. We're not going to invest in something, put our customers' capital towards something, I wouldn't recommend it, that's not proven. So when we look at the long term, we need to look at that cryogenic storage, the liquid air energy storage, after it's built and functioning. And if the plans go through and something is built by 2024, 25, someplace else, we can watch it for a few years, get some operational information and see if, do we want to continue that down that road and ride that horse. But that still doesn't get us any place by 2024. So here's where we need a.
Commissioner Olson's here with a question. Partners, utilities?
Other utilities.
And we talked about the examples you gave were only within our service area. We're not.
We would be building something in our service area because we don't have transmission issues then. But we might be able to partner with other utilities up and down the west side.
Okay, got it.
So we have ascertained that it's important to build it in our service territory.
We have found that one of our critical linkages, one of our critical vulnerabilities is the transmission system. If there was a Cascadia earthquake, we could be out of power for months from the east side. That's what Bonneville had indicated about their transmission system, worst case. So if we can build something in our service territory and our transmission system sends it to where it needs to be, then we don't have to rely on something outside the service area.
I guess I was thinking along the lines of like we do, participate in wind farms. I know there's some big, large-scale projects that are being discussed, right? I think, isn't there even one being permitted, pump storage project in the state?
There are a number. There are, I could probably count less than 10, but more than 5
yeah.
that are currently in licensing or construction.
It just seems like it is potentially cost-saving to be part of a large project. That's what I was trying to understand.
And that's part of the due diligence
yeah.
process.
Yeah.
We can't get it here.
Well, it's not that we can't get it here if we have catastrophic failure.
Oh, that, but it seems like,
I guess it seems like if we have catastrophic failure, we have a problem serving load anyway. I don't know, I'm just trying to think of the scale. Because I do remember the presentation about Spain that look we did.
And again, that's still possible, but it's going to take us a while to.
Yeah, sure. I understand.
The absolute yes.
We're jumping.
We are.
So, in the short term, to meet that 2024, 2025 timeframe, commercial grade battery energy storage, lithium ion storage is a proven technology. We're looking through, do we buy or do we rent? We do an energy services agreement. We build it ourselves, more to come on that, but it is a proven technology, and it's a down payment of what we need in the long term.
And so would it be in our distribution system, or would it be part of our transmission system?
It would be within our service area, close to a substation, so that we could get into the transmission system to feed the distribution system.
Okay.
What little bit I know about pump storage is that it can be very expensive to do the pumping itself, the cost of the pumping after it's built. And you're supposed to, usually, don't you choose to pump when rates are really low? You don't pump when rates are high?
The ideal situation is yes, when it's just sort of like the any of the capacity products that we've been talking about, the Garrison just mentioned, you want to use that low cost, off-peak energy, refill the battery, whether it's a water battery or a lithium ion battery, and then use it during the peak periods.
Use it during the peak, right. But not pump during the peak.
It depends on what you need.
Yeah.
If your battery is low and you need to recharge it so that you can avoid the higher cost that's in the market for a capacity product, it might still make sense to pump even during a peak.
I see.
It's an operational
balance.
Fact. It's a dance. It's a choreography. That's right. Any questions on the technologies we've just talked about?
Oh, I've got 100 more, but I until we have the full presentation.
Now I'm going to take the baton and hand it back to Garrison, who can continue to walk us through the what.
Yes, sir. So Brent shared a little bit about what we looked at in 2022, what we found. You know, we're really looking for that commodity grade kind of scale that we've seen out there developed in California, elsewhere, time and time again. There's other things that we need to be thinking about that's changing in our environment that should inform our strategy. There's things that are changing, right? Connect up, how that rolls out and our opportunities there, how that can scale. That can be more potential for us, and we need to make sure that we're taking advantage of the potential there as well. That could be a capacity resource for us. Post 2028 contract, we came and briefed the board, I believe, in the last meeting. There's a lot there that could move up or down our portfolio needs, and we need to make sure that we are planning for what that could look like appropriately. Brian Booth and his great team have shared the electrification load forecast. That's new as of the 2021 IRP. Will absolutely be part of the next one, but we need to make sure that we're responding to that. Resource technologies being developed all the time, some really exciting ones, even here in Everett. And we've talked as well about some organized market developments with this board and what those could look like. That's also part of the reason why we think a resource in Snohomish County or Kameno Island is a good move for us, because that helps us with some of the transmission congestion, which does get priced into markets, and that could be an additional tool for us as well. So there's a lot of reasons, you know, that we think we need to get started, but we need to be aware of the changing operating environment so we don't get in front of our skis, but we're reacting nimbly to the operating environment around us. So that is why we've got this holistic strategy that really takes what we've learned, takes our resource strategy, and says, what can we do now with a low risk of regret? It's this 25 megawatt, 100 megawatt hour battery energy storage. We want to get that adjacent to local infrastructure to keep the cost down, build on our experience, like at the microgrid, where I know folks visited recently. This is the most commercially available storage technology. It's also a very deep market in terms of suppliers and developers, so we can get good costs there and take advantage of this tax credit. This is going to reduce our exposure to a capacity market that has been more and more expensive in recent years. This does not mean that we stop looking at the long-term solutions like liquid air energy storage and local pump storage hydro. We'll continue doing that work in the background to see what we can do for the long term, looking at those 30-year plus asset lives, because we expect to serve our customers for a long time. But we need to take a step now to make sure that we're in a good position. And we'll continue to look at what our needs are in the next IRP with the new electrification load forecast and see what the next things to layer on top of that are. So that's where we're at in bullet points. And Brad mentioned he's a pictorial person. So here's that in pictorial form, which is to say we're defining that first tranche of the navy blue there, and this step today, we're going to be looking at that purple tranche and see what can we do with that that works great for our customers, works great for us. Really working with Jeff's group to get the conservation on time and on target there. We're looking locally at some small solar that we can do. We've got some projects in the works that might be a 2023 thing that we look at together. Our goal is really to be flexible and proactive so that we can rise to the challenge of the future for our customers, where they need us to be. So that is the why, the what, and the when. I think we're rounding third base here with the what and the how. I would call this the how a little bit. And I'm going to ask Angela from finance, who's been doing a lot of great work with the team, to share this one with us.
I'm Angela Johnston, manager of financing and risk management. I am fairly shorter than you, so I'll get that down. Basically, what I wanted to do is expand that arrow pointing towards 2024. Our first steps, as we've discussed, we believe that it is best to move forward with a 25 megawatt lithium-ion battery. How do we move forward structurally, both operationally and financially, that optimizes all of our needs, all of our goals, all of our expectations for this program? is very complex, as you've been hearing. It's full of lots of variables and dependencies. So we've been gathering this cross-functional team and trying to define what that might look like. So as we move forward, we're going to continue to refine that structure, but there are a few things that we know that we can expect based on all of the pre-work of this team and research that we've done with various consultants. So one of the things that we do know is that we can expect this battery to have a useful life of around 15 years. We also know, as we go into depth, that we now have tax credits that we can leverage to optimize whatever structure that we come up with and that meets these goals. We also know that, based on our pre-working discussions, that the cost of a battery will be around $5 to $8 million annualized.
No, the battery.
Of the battery, the structure that we would develop.
Okay. Oh,
yeah. With the structures that we.
I know we got a lot of.
Yeah. No. With the structures that we have available to the district, it's about $5 to $8 million annualized. So, but we also know that we have the Hay Canyon power agreements that are rolling off in March of 2024, and we expect to be able to reallocate some of these dollars to offset the costs of. We have a couple goals that we are taking into consideration as we move forward with the development of the structure. We want to make sure that as much risk as possible is transferred to third parties. We believe we can do this with strong contractual agreements that really defines what our expectations are and what we need. For this resource plan, we also want a structure that helps us to prioritize our timeline that is both aggressive but necessary. We've been talking a lot about the need to optimize our ability to take advantage of the tax credits that has the language in it that we would want to start construction in 2024. We also want to be able to show that we are building our capacity to comply with our 2025 resource adequacy requirements. So we're taking all of these goals, all of the expectations that we've established so far, we're refining them, we're going to be putting them together into an RFP that defines everything that we need. And to stick with our timeline, our aggressive but necessary timeline, is that we want to get this RFP out in the first quarter.
Are we looking to have someone build a turnkey project for us? Is that
we have several options that are available to the district, and that is one of the options that we are looking at. We referenced earlier in this conversation there are several. Turnkey is one of them. We have also the availability of doing ESAs. Our desire is to come away with a structure that leverages all of our goals, which is most cost effective but also sticks with that timeline. So we'll be looking at a lot of different things as we go and refine our RFP.
Following on that question, so this third party, would those be long-term contracts with the third parties? Okay. Thank you.
All right, I'll hand it back over. I'm going to let you guys do the slidey thing because I haven't done that before.
So we are the last piece here. This is really the how, right? We're getting into the timeline pieces. Scott Spar, I don't know if you're beaming in from the speakers there, but I think this is something Scott was maybe going to speak to. Scott, we're looking up at the ceiling tiles to see if you'll come down from the ceiling tiles. We might go ahead.
Here I am. Can you hear me now?
Oh, look at that. Perfect.
All right. Perfect. Good. Well, thanks for having me. I'm apologetic that I couldn't be there in person. I'm talking to you live from the Jackson Project, and my morning didn't allow me there either in person, but I've been listening in. And yeah, I wanted to talk about the way that we see the project delivery on this this battery energy storage solution working out. I'll start off by saying that activities are already underway with this kind of short timeline and the carrots out there between the tax incentive and other resource needs. We hit the ground running already. A lot of the information that is going on behind the scenes has been informed by our partnership with Sound Grid Solutions, which does a lot of consulting work for delivery of similar scale battery storage projects to both public and private enterprises like the PUD. Scott Gibson and myself have collaborated on this again with a broader team that includes substation and real estate and other folks from around the district. And I've got a very simplified timeline that describes what is internally a lot of complicated or ambitious steps, but highly achievable given our track record of delivering the Arlington Microgrid, Youngs Creek, Hancock, Callaghan, Qualco, et cetera. Here we are in 2022. Yeah, go ahead.
This may sound like a ridiculous question. Would Jackson be in the area of consideration for site-specific batteries?
We did. We had a lot of discussion about where to place this particular facility. And the key considerations there are proximity to transmission and some other system protection needs, as well as the availability to get a shovel-ready, permit-ready project built. The Jackson campus just doesn't have enough free space at the moment. We do intend to see about expanding that because maybe future stages of battery storage might be set at Jackson. Currently, a lot of the focus is at our North County site. We could get into specifics of that, but I probably have a limited time, so I want to walk you through kind of the bulk of the procurement steps. What we're presently doing is we are collecting information from the bulk battery suppliers, the Teslas, the GEs of the world. And we're doing that through a non-binding request for information. The parlance that I call that is, kind of a budget level quote from those entities. And we're going to use that information to follow up with a request for proposal. And the distinction between those two is one is non-binding, kind of soliciting interest and input, and the second one is a binding contract vehicle. And we'll be working on that in 2023. Our preferred vehicle is a energy storage agreement where this third party contractor would provide the 25 megawatt, 100 megawatt hour battery energy storage, essentially Connex buildings with the battery racks in there. But there would be a big participation from the PUD in completing the real estate, the site prep, potentially constructing the substation, and basically presenting this ESA with a prepped site. So that ESA contract and all those pre-development work will be going on in 2023. Construction happens in 2024 and extended to 2025 if necessary. As Garrison mentioned, that's our target completion date. So it by all measures, that's been something that's achievable by our outreach to the industry, and we should be able to follow up on that. I'm gonna pause for any questions.
Outreach to the industry, it has the potential for due to supply delivery issues for the batteries not to be available when we want them.
Yeah, you know, I think that the simple answer to that question is we will engineer the contract to have financial penalties that would go along to that supplier to kind of ensure that that we're going to get delivery. Basically, we would share our costs of not having the project completed into kind of a liquidated damages clause on the ESA.
But I'll just jump in there a little bit. Many of our peers are pursuing battery storage and other projects, renewable projects and such. Supply chain is a continuing to be a significant risk. So I know we can build in and will build into the contracts some language that helps protect us. But the bottom line is, and this is some of our peers' experiences, if they can't get it, they can't get it. And there's still risk, supply chain risk out there.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I would just add under this new tax credit that we can get, there's a domestic content requirement that the IRS and Treasury are still figuring out exactly what percentage of the battery or the resource has to be made in the USA. So that may add another layer to the supply chain issue.
Well, part of the political picture is that we hope that there will be a lot more manufacturing domestically. Manufacturing of these things that we're waiting on from China and elsewhere. So I don't know enough about what is actually being focused on, but I mean, I know chips, but I don't know about battery related things, whether those will be possibly produced here in the US. I'm hoping we really need more manufacturing in this country, more jobs too.
I do believe that is a focus. I know not so much from the utility perspective, but on manufacturing, GM, others are spending extraordinary amounts of money building battery factories. But the other part of this is, like us, there's going to be a lot of other companies that are going to go after these tax credits. Yeah, so that kind of exacerbates the issue. So. Again, you raise a very good point, and it's just to say there is risk out there. How quickly the battery building capacity can move up or increase, the timing of a lot of the projects that are going to go on and be incentivized by the tax credits. It's all going to be in play.
So that's where we get in the key there.
Yes, exactly.
Well, they're on warp speed. Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was talking about.
The law is just the instant driving
the law. Storage of energy.
Yeah.
I recognize that, but is there a plan B? It seems to me that batteries, based upon a previous slide, are the most cost effective.
Yep, batteries.
And exist.
Batteries are
a prep tested technology.
You know, the plan B is really what we've been doing, right, which is going out into that market for capacity. We're going to be exposed to price volatility. So I think Commissioner Logan said, you know, part of the strategy for addressing the supply chain potential out there is to be early in that queue, right? We're not looking at the second tranche of the tax credit program. We're looking at the first tranche. Those rules are known. We can get out there in the first quarter of 2023 with an RFP, find a partner, we'll provide the land. That's our expectation, because that'll cut down costs, keep us close to infrastructure. We should be able to be one of the fastest projects in the country. And so we should be an attractive partner, but we need to market ourselves and we need to find the market. And with those yes, member words, I'll hand it off here to Brad for the last part, which is, battery is one thing that we're doing for the near term to set us up for success, but we've got the long-term vision too.
Brad Spangler, Senior Manager, Generation. Local pump storage hydro, we talked a little bit about earlier. We said we currently have studies ongoing. We're looking at the environmental impacts. We're looking at water quality impacts. We're reaching out to stakeholders. We have a team that we've put together who can reach out to those stakeholders to work with them. And should the fatal flaws not show up, we will continue through a preliminary provincial licensing and look at having construction completed by somewhere in the neighborhood of 2033. And that's the 100-year asset. If you're looking at liquid air energy storage, it's a 30-year asset, but, and maybe a little sooner, but you'd have to repeat it several times. Yeah. Battery energy storage, great short-term solution, stackable, scalable, but they're good for about 10, 15 years, depending on cycling. So nothing's free.
But it's proven technology.
It is proven technology. Pump storage hydro is also proven technology. We just have to figure out, is it right for us? So that takes us to our next steps. The right solution that we've come up with as a team so far is a battery energy storage system. Scott mentioned we have an RFI going out. Angela mentioned a targeted RFP by the end of first quarter. We'll continue our due diligence on local pump storage hydro. And in 2023, another IRP. We'll look at what further changes there might be to the direction based on market and based on what other people are doing. So I think we've shown you that we've got a yes in yes member. It's a good thing. I like that term. Barring any questions.
Well, I'd like you to be on warp speed times two.
Yeah. Double warp speed.
Commissioner Olson is not all that thrilled with market.
Understand. We will we'll smoke the fire.
Thank you. Commissioner Wolf, any other questions?
No, really looking forward to the 2023 IRP process. Earlier when I talked about the cost of pumping, I should have provided a little more context about that. Pumping itself requires energy. And so that is the piece I was thinking about.
Yes, and so, this is Jason. And I mean, you are correct. You're thinking about that correctly. When energy prices are high, that pump storage is gonna flow back down and generate power and help us use that market exposure, and when prices are low, in overnight hours or maybe middle of the day, then we're going to be running those pumps, if that comes to fruition, pumping that water back up into the reservoir.
That's really true with all three options.
Yes.
Battery, we're going to be buying power, hopefully at a low cost to charge it.
That's correct.
Breathing air, hopefully the same thing, we'll be buying it at a time when it's inexpensive and plentiful. So,
yes.
I mean, they have the same similar challenge.
Yeah.
I don't know what the losses are, but
yeah, I mean, a little different. But pump storage, I know it's a net, at the end of the day, it's a net load, right?
Yeah.
So you,
I'm sure they all are a net load.
Yes.
Yeah.
The cooling systems of those batteries are free.
Yeah. No, they're not. We found that out. You know, just one more thing that I'll add is one, we got a great team working on this to get through it as quickly as we can. It is a lot of new stuff for us to explore. I mean, the law just passed, so kind of unpacking that, understanding that, and how we can really leverage that to our benefit. And then as we move forward and look at the longer term, whether that's pump storage, liquid air energy storage, we're going to evaluate that through the lens of the IRP and what our needs are. So there'll be kind of that continuous evaluation, and we'll have stage gates in line there to help us make those informed decisions. And the IRP is going to be affected this year by electrification. So we will see that new load forecast that Brian Booth and his team put together, that's going to funnel into the IRP, and we may see some different outcomes. So we'll continue to evaluate those things through that lens.
I think that slide 10 really shows it all that Brett shows. When you look at pumped hydro and other options, I mean, we're never going to regret building a storage project that has more capabilities than we see the need for right now. Because even if we don't need all that storage in the future, others will need that storage. And that storage will be, it'll be commoditized.
Excellent. All right, just to echo Jason's comments, though, we are fortunate to have such an extraordinary team working on this project. I know they are all over it. So that is it for the morning session. I'm President James.
Thank you, John. It is now 10:31, and the board will recess into executive session to discuss current or potential litigation under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meetings Act. It is anticipated the executive session will last approximately 30 minutes with no public announcements. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission room at 1:30 p.m. Thank you.